Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
It's Friday, the 27th of November. Good morning and thanks for choosing Africa Link. I'm Crispin Mwakideu in Bonn, Germany. In this edition of Africa Link, hundreds of thousands of worshippers attend Mass in Nairobi conducted by Pope Francis, but some had complaints.
So many people are scattered everywhere, pushing each other, and it was a trouble. We were beaten by the police.
And a former child soldier from the Democratic Republic of Congo shares his experiences in his adopted homeland of Canada.
And I'd always had a mentality that I would go back to Congo somehow, start my own military so I can stop people that use child soldiers. That was my mindset for a very long time, and it was about revenge. And
plus, an EU ultimatum to Burundi over the ongoing violence expired on Thursday. We find out what's next. These stories and more right after this.
Top story.
We begin in Kenya, where Pope Francis today lashed out at wealthy minorities who hoard resources at the expense of the poor. The Pope made the comments as he visited Kangemi slum in the Kenyan capital. On Thursday, he conducted his first public mass in Africa. Some 10,000 security officers were deployed, and the Nairobi police say an estimated 300,000 people attended the service. The number falls way short of the 1.4 million Kenyan authorities had earlier predicted. Our correspondent in Nairobi, James Shimanyula, was there too and filed this report.
Themes of the Pope's homily at the open-air High Mass in Nairobi included strengthening the family unit, peace, stability, interreligious and inter-ethnic tolerance, as well as inclusivity.
Here, in the heart of this university, where the minds and hearts of new generations are being shaped, I appeal in a special way to the young people of the nation. Let the great values of Africa's traditions, the wisdom and truth of God's word, and the generous idealism of your youth guide you in working to shape a society which is ever more just, inclusive, and respectful of human dignity. May you always be concerned for the needs of the poor and reject everything that leads to prejudice and discrimination. For these things we know are not of God.
Lo sappiamo non sono di Dio.
The unique and historic ceremony was beamed live locally on screens at the adjacent university sports ground and two adjoining public parks where more screens were mounted. The English translation of the Mass was relayed through a public address system to all the venues. The High Mass in Nairobi ended peacefully but was preceded by incidents of security personnel using force to control huge crowds, with some people forcing open one of the steel gates after they had waited for more than 6 hours. Here are some of the people that claimed to have been roughed up by security personnel and others who entered the venue of the Mass after waiting for long hours.
So many people were scattered everywhere, pushing each other, and it was a trouble. We were beaten by the police, so
there was a commotion. The security guards started pushing people back, and people started falling, some stepping on others. And
want to see him face to face, then to get that great message that he has for us.
I'm very happy because surely I've come to meet really the head of the church in the world, Pope Francis.
The Pope leaves Kenya Friday for Uganda, his second leg of a three-nation visit, which will be followed by a visit to the Central African Republic.
James Shimanyula reporting in Nairobi. After celebrating Mass, Pope Francis delivered a speech at the Nairobi headquarters of the United Nations Environment Programme and the Human Settlements Programme. In his speech, the 78-year-old pontiff said everyone has the basic right to dignified living conditions. DW's Daniel Pels is in Nairobi, where he followed the speech and later spoke to Mark Caldwell.
Well, the Pope particularly focused on the COP21 climate summit that is supposed to kick off in a few days in Paris, where world leaders are supposed to agree on a binding treaty to cut global carbon dioxide emissions. And the Pope said it would be catastrophic if they would fail to reach a binding agreement to cut these emissions. He also made a very, very strong call to political leaders, to the business community and to the scientific community to work together to find ways to fight global climate change. But he also had a very uplifting message. He said actually positive change is possible. He said human beings have proved time and again that they are able to actually change for the better and improve this world.
Now, climate change is already making itself felt in Africa in the form of extreme weather conditions. This is having an impact on a continent that is very reliant on small-scale agriculture. Did Pope Francis address this issue?
He did not specifically refer to Africa, but indeed he, of course, said that the poor are actually the ones who bear the brunt of climate change, although they contribute least to global carbon dioxide emissions. But they feel the effects more than others do. So definitely, and not just in the speech that he gave at the United Nations, but also in other speeches he has given before, and in his encyclical Laudato Si, which he published in May, he pointed that very fact out, that the poor are actually the main victims of climate change.
How accessible was this speech? Do you think he succeeded in reaching out to non-Catholics?
Yeah, I think he did, because he used very, very clear language. He did not refer to the Bible. He didn't preach to the people as such, but he used very straightforward language. At the same time, you could see he was very, very passionate. He did not simply read the speech as such, just like a diplomat or a head of state might have to deliver a speech somewhere. You could really see that it was extremely important to him to say what he had to say. And I think that really captured the attention of the people in the auditorium. People were extremely attentive. You didn't see this usual kind of thing that people are looking at their smartphones or writing emails on the side. In fact, the audience was glued to his lips. And I think also people who watched that speech through TV are definitely captured by the way he delivered it and by the words that he used.
Daniel Pels in Nairobi. Well, let's stay with the challenges facing our environment, particularly in Africa. Lake Chad is drying up. Over the last 50 years, it has lost 90% of its water. And this is having a devastating impact not only on ecosystems, but also on millions of residents who depend on the lake for their livelihood. Mochi Kinzeka with this report from a village around Lake Chad's basin.
It's another day and Kananda Sule is once again casting his nets in the waters. The 40-year-old family man is one of the few fishermen in Katikine village in the Lake Chad Basin who depend on fishing. But Sule says their catch has been reducing as years go. Because of that, the number of fishermen has also taken a nosedive. In 1992, there were 55 fishermen in Katikine. Now, only five remain.
When we arrived here, there were a lot of arbres.
When we settled here, there were many trees and grasses. There were animals. Many people came here to fish. There were lots of animals, but now there is nothing, and the fish is almost finished.
According to the UN, by 2012, nearly 30 million people in six countries, including Chad, Niger, and Cameroon, were dependent on the lake. However, 90% of its waters have disappeared within 50 years. Countries whose population depends on the lake now say they want to transfer water from the majestic 3,690,000 square kilometers Congo River Basin to the Chad River Basin. The Congo Basin is the world's second largest after the Amazon River. Swaibu Mahaman, environmental expert at the Lake Chad Basin Commission, says the project should be given its due importance by world leaders when they meet in Paris for talks on climate change.
Lake Chad is reduced by 90% from 25,000 square kilometers in 1960, but the population that is the lake is the only source of livelihood has increased from 3.5 million to over 40 million inhabitants. This excludes animals, plants, and birds that also exert pressure on the disappearing lake.
But for the water diversion project to go ahead, the governments of DR Congo, Central African Republic, and Congo-Brazzaville must allow the six member countries of the Lake Chad Basin Commission to use water resources in their territories. The experts say they await the green light in Paris. The project is estimated at $14.5 billion, and that money has yet to be found. Mana Bukari, representative of the executive secretary of the Lake Chad Basin Commission, says the drying lake has brought untold suffering to people. He says Nigerian Islamist group Boko Haram is now making use of the economic hardship to recruit.
Youths in the Lake Chad Basin are joining the Boko Haram terrorist group because of lack of jobs and difficult economic conditions, resulting from the drying up of the lake and the disappearance of its resources.
The drying up of Lake Chad, like many other river basins in the world, has been attributed to changing weather patterns and human activity that leads to global warming.
And that report was compiled by Moki Kinzeka.
Get the stories that are shaping the continent here on Africa Link.
You're listening to Africa Link live from DW Studios in Bonn, Germany. And still to come, what you had to say about the stories we have been covering on Africa Link, our website dw.com/Africa, and on social media. Stick around.
Human rights.
The good, the bad, and the good again. That's the story of Michel Chikwanine, a former child soldier. Michel was just 5 when he was abducted by militants in the Democratic Republic of Congo. He had been out playing soccer with friends. As part of his initiation into a rebel army, he was dragged and forced to kill his best friend with an assault rifle. Michel has gone public with his harrowing experiences. A recent visit to his high school in Ottawa, Canada, where he was adopted, ended up being a very emotional occasion. Sian Griffiths reports.
He leaves those who listen a new perspective on life, a desire to be a positive force in a world struggling to birth a new consciousness.
It's an emotional homecoming for 27-year-old Michel Chikwanine. Helen Zettel, one of his old teachers, is oozing with pride, tearful as she introduces him to a new generation of students.
He has made us so proud. Please join me in welcoming back Michel.
Michel is beaming as he walks on stage. Now that he is the student's complete attention, he begins to tell his story, just one of many to come out of the conflict in the Democratic Republic of Congo. At 12, Michel lost his father. The death of his father, a towering figure at nearly 7 feet tall, clearly still aches to this day. The love and esteem he felt for his father is evident in this extract from his book, Child Soldier, When Boys and Girls Are Used in War.
I would sit close beside my dad while we listened to the news on the radio. He told me about the world, and though I didn't understand half of it, I loved being near him.
Michel drives home the importance to his young audience of being courageous in pursuit of your goals. His presentation is clearly making an impact on the students of St. Pat's.
It's really scary to think that these children aren't going to school. They have to fight in wars, and they're going through things that even grown men cry about.
To have courage to talk in front of a lot of people, to talk about bad things that had happened to him. Because a lot of people would go through that and be traumatized and just be trapped and not like open up to people. So him doing that really showed me that anything's possible.
Today, Michel's an advocate for peace, but that wasn't always his plan. He reveals how he could have continued the cycle of violence, but made a different choice.
And I'd always had a mentality that I would go back to Congo somehow, start my own military so I can stop people that use child soldiers. That was my mindset for a very long time, and it was about revenge and all these ideas. And it becomes this just continual process of violence. Just violence never solves violence. It just makes more violence. And so from that moment onwards, I forgave them.
Michel has shared his personal experiences with hundreds of thousands of mainly young people across North America. His hope, he says, is to inspire people to create change. At the end of his presentation, he issues a call to think, a call to act.
If there's someone that's being bullied, don't feel afraid to stand up for them. That means you're a human being and you care. And that's the most important thing that I think every single one of us can do, having the ability to care for each other.
And that report was compiled by Sean Griffiths. Join us on Friday for our next human rights story. Burundi is at risk of genocide. Thomas Perriello, U.S. Special Envoy for the Great Lakes region, sent out that warning on Thursday. The United Nations say 240 people have been killed in Burundi since April, while more than 200,000 have fled the country. The crisis was sparked by President Pierre Nkurunziza's bid for a controversial third term. The European Union imposed an ultimatum on Burundi to enter into dialogue or face the suspension of development cooperation. Ulrich Delius works for the Society for Threatened Peoples based here in Germany, and he's been telling Mark Caldwell the next step the EU may likely take.
It seems that it's not really moving ahead. Everybody's trying to make pressure on the Burundian government. Even the US government has imposed sanctions this week, and everybody hopes that they will move ahead with the idea of an inclusive dialogue with the political opposition. But until now, so a few hours before this ultimatum will terminate, we don't think that there's real movement on the ground. So the question is what to do now? What are you doing with a government which is quite ignoring international protests?
If the EU were to suspend development cooperation, what would that entail?
Yeah, it will have massive consequences for not only the civilian population in this country, but also for the economy. Burundi is relying on the international cooperation with the European Union. So the long-term perspectives of such a move to stop development cooperation will be very important. But I guess that the Burundian government is not thinking about the long-term effects, but only how to survive the next week.
What has the European Union done so far to end the violence in Burundi, to encourage stability and good governance? What steps has the EU taken?
So the EU has been working for a long time on making pressure on the Burundian government, trying to incite them for more dialogue with the political opposition. They even imposed sanctions against four personalities of the security system on October the 1st. But until now, there was no real reaction. So it's a bit of a last weapon. Some people think that the European Union might use now to stop all development cooperation.
So further sanctions won't work. Is that what you're saying?
I think it's necessary to decide about new sanctions on one hand, but on the other hand, we have to think about the other perspectives. So what about the threat of full-fledged civil war? And are the European Union, the African Union, the United Nations really prepared for such a full-fledged civil war? And why are they not preparing a peacekeeping mission of the African Union or United Nations? Because everybody knows that it takes a lot of time to prepare such a mission, and most governments have in mind what has been happening in the neighboring country in Rwanda. The genocide is always mentioned, and the threat of the genocide also in Burundi. So we think having in mind the principle of the protection of the civilian population, you should prepare now for an escalation of violence and the international answer to such an escalation.
Ulrich Delius from the Society for Threatened Peoples here in Germany.
Your say.
Well, it's time now to hand over the microphone over to you and hear your opinions on the stories we've been covering. Abubakar Jallow and Maya Schweder with this week's your say.
Hi, let's begin with our opinion question for this week. Pope Francis is visiting Kenya, and we ask, how much impact do you think his visit will have in Kenya?
Ras Manco in Tanzania said Pope Francis should set up new rules that allow Catholic priests to have families, because many of the priests have families in secret anyway. And Aliyu Muhammad in Nigeria said Pope Francis is coming to Africa at a time when the continent is facing many challenges, including increasing terrorism, civil wars, and abuse on women and children. Aliyu hopes the Pope will pray for Africa's problems to go away.
And now, after the outpouring support we saw for France in the recent attacks on its capital, Paris, our very own Crispin Mwakideyo wrote an opinion piece asking, does every life matter when terror strikes? African critics accused Western media of double standards when covering terror attacks, but Crispin thinks Africans should first look in their back doors before they begin the blame game. Listen to this excerpt of the piece.
Africa should start questioning its own fatalism towards death and start valuing every single person's life more. Whether you die at the hands of terrorists, curable or incurable diseases, or a reckless driver, your life deserves to be mourned by everyone. I strongly believe that Africa should first respond with one voice every time Al-Shabaab or Boko Haram Islamist terrorists kill innocent civilians. Only when we begin to respect the sanctity of every life will the rest of the world follow.
That article got many responses on our website, dw.com, and on Facebook. John McPherson wrote, "There is undeniably a double standard when it comes to U.S. media coverage. I do not condone it, nor do I defend it. Much of what Crispin Mwakideyo comments on is true, and some of it is probably ideas whose time have come." Mary Safian said, "On the continent of Africa and in the country of Lebanon, terror attacks happen frequently and have happened over a long period of time. It's getting old. Sadly, you get hardened to it, and it's old news. Paris hasn't seen terror attacks on that scale, so it will garner more attention."
Barry Fisher wrote, "I hate to say that something so obvious is a good point, but well, the Western media needs an overhaul and to do some serious soul-searching as to what their mission really is. Lives in Africa and Ukraine and other parts of the world matter as well." Sheila Parmenter wrote, "Surely it should be the priority of Western media to broadcast Western news first and the rest of the world later. I would also like to ask, do African media give priority to events in African states before those of Europe? It works both ways."
Dionys KC wrote, "Every media reports events in their own territory more extensively. Paris is situated in a Western country. Who has double standards? If someone doesn't report this way, then shame on them. After Paris, all European people have become more aware of the pain such events cause worldwide, and therefore much, much more attention is going to be paid from now on, even to other countries out of Europe." Kevin Ochieng summed it all up by saying, "All our African leaders can do is talk and loot from their own people."
And finally, the number of Syrian and Iraqi refugees arriving here in Europe has raised a lot of concerns about terrorism in Europe.
Joel Ezekia in Kenya wrote to say he does not think many of the refugees are actual refugees. He said some of them are in Europe to spread radical Islamist ideology and terror.
And that's all for this week.
Abubakar Jallo and Maya Schrader. If you'd like to contribute to Your Say, simply send us your opinion on the stories we air here on Africa Link, either via text message to country code 49160-957-59510. The number again, 49160-957-59510. An email to feedback.africa@dw.com or a letter to Africa Link, DW 53110, Bonn, Germany. And You Say we'll be back at the same time next week.
Listen to Africa Link whenever you want. Sign up for our podcast at dw.de/Africa Link podcast.
Before we leave you, a reminder of our main stories. While visiting a Kenyan slum, Pope Francis has criticized wealthy minorities who hoard resources at the expense of the poor. We have also been hearing about the political crisis in Burundi and the experiences of a former child soldier from the Democratic Republic of Congo. And that's all we had for you in this edition of Africa Link. Abubakar Jallo will be here on Monday next week, and I'm very sure he would appreciate your company. For me, Crispin Mwakideyo, have a wonderful weekend.